There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
Our subscribers and members of our listening audience.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Fall, my co-host. Desiree is on holiday. This is podcast number 255, February 27th, 2008. Steven?
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com web surf for the ads that interest you. From memorabilia to trash, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them, you know you want to.
Keep up the good work, Yahoo Ads. And of course, thank you, Stephen. On today's show, Coulthard out, Vettel in. Flavio, we have no secret wing. Hamilton. And Shumi says, keep your eyes on Nico Rosberg. So there you have it, Stephen. Welcome to the F1Weekly.com roundtable. NASA's white Camry limousine has yet to pull up to the studio, so we are going ahead. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Yourself, Mr. Rogers?
Not too bad. When I saw that big headline, Coulthard out due to injury and Vettel in, I was stunned. And I was worried for, of course, the biggest Coulthard fan in the world, of course, Mr. Tricky Dick.
And it really looks very similar to an incident we saw, 2 years ago at the middle of the season when Jacques Villeneuve had a stiff neck after a shunt in Hockenheim, I believe it was. And suddenly he was moving to NASCAR.
Do you believe that, or are you insinuating that David Coulthard will very soon hear the words, "Ya fired"?
I doubt it, seriously. Both teams have announced their lineups for the year. It was kind of odd. We thought that Sebastian was the one that they dropped into the car. But at least my thoughts were that the regular test driver was already engaged, possibly driving in one of the GP2 series this upcoming weekend and was unable to get back for the race. But you made a good point in the fact that it would actually be a great opportunity for the Red Bull teams to get some cross-feedback on the new Adrian Newey chassis that Red Bull's using, as well as engine performance with traction control.
I absolutely agree. My point is that I think, is it really legal for you to test one team's car and then jump and test another team's car? I find it fascinating, and this is where that customer car option rears its head. I mean, this gives Red Bull and Toro Rosso an advantage because they could jump from an old Adrian Newey design that's powered by Ferrari and then jump to the new RB4 Adrian Newey design, which is powered by Renault, and he could give probably a lot of technical input, because I have a funny feeling this young Vettel is technically inclined.
Yeah, are both the Red Bull cars using the same transmission?
I don't believe so. As a matter of fact, the mounting of the motor for Renault and Ferrari is completely different.
So it's going to be a different transmission. So they could be giving feedback on the nuances with the lack of traction control between the two transmission sets, too.
Exactly. But, you know, I don't know all of the details, but I still think the advantage is to Vettel. And kudos to him. He probably did a great job. And, of course, Coulthard is expected back first thing in the morning.
Did he fall out of bed or something?
No.
Hear how he hurt his neck?
I heard it was a masseuse. But that's off the record. So there you have it. Let's just get back to some of the times in Spain. And they had decent weather, dry track. A lot of people were running. Of course, we know Super Aguri couldn't make it. But Renault out there, one more day, doing a fantastic job. This is it, gentlemen.
The final test.
This is the final test. We're talking 2 weeks.
Pack now. Your bags for Australia, boys.
And I'm telling you, I cannot wait to get this show on the road. But apparently, a lot of, you know, now Ferrari is starting to say that this is going to be a big challenge this year, because it looks like Mercedes, McLaren, they look pretty quick. Hamilton on the timesheets all day long. I got tired of it. The press, every 5 minutes, Hamilton this, Hamilton that, Hamilton on top, on top, on top.
And the fact they know all the cheat codes for the EMU.
Exactly. That's right. Being a PlayStation 2 professional and 3, he does get all the cheat codes for the Microsoft. So I guess that would be Xbox 360 codes.
Exactly. Yeah, McLaren's building the EMUs, and so I think they know all the cheat codes.
Exactly. And, of course, Renault having flown in some more aero parts early in the week to try to get as much pace out of the car that they possibly can. Fernando Alonso quoting, saying, "We know we can do it. We just need to find it."
But no W-wing.
No W-wing. Very disappointing, but they could be sandbagging. As Marc Genet said last week, he believes Renault is sandbagging. But I don't know. And the other team to watch right now is Williams. BMW have not performed well, but they could be sandbagging as well. I'm really not too keen on the antlers growing out of the front nose of the car. It's not only very attractive, but I don't think it gives them an edge in any which way.
No, I don't think that buys them much. I think it's probably ultimately creating more drag than it is providing downforce that they're looking for. I agree with you that I think Williams might be a dark horse this season in the fact that they've been pretty strong. They've got a good driver. Their second driver, Nakajima, has been driving reasonably well and has been putting himself towards the top of the sheets. So it looks like they've got a pretty strong car.
They got a good handling car, good tight suspension. And when Michael Schumacher says they're the ones to watch, and of course he was pointed at Nico, but because there really wasn't that much news about Michael on Monday testing, but he did say that Nico was one to watch. I find that very intriguing, and Nico Rosberg's got the talent if he's got the package, and we know what Nasser says, it's the package.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, you can always, if you've got a good package, you really don't need a great driver.
Exactly, and we haven't heard too much about the undependability of any of the cars in testing for the past few weeks, be it a McLaren, Ferrari. I mean, they've had a few engine blow-ups, Ferrari has.
Yeah, well, that would be expected. We're basically running the same engine as last season. You've maybe got some support parts that have changed, but generally you're running the same internal workings on these cars. The EMUs have changed, but that really doesn't affect engine performance so much. So I wouldn't expect cars to have mechanical failures. They're kind of running the same guts as they have been. They're just playing with the aero packages these days.
And, of course, let's not forget Force India. Got two cars out there. It looks good, and they seem to have some dependability. They ran almost 1,000 kilometers in the past few days, and they're really pushing. And Vijay is a serious man, and I think Fernando, excuse me, Fisichella, bravo, bravo, bravo. I think he will help the team in developing the car, but we'll see how long he stays during the season. It's very possible that Vitantonio has a chance of leapfrogging his fellow Roman.
Yeah, all has everything to do with Fizzy's race performance and how he does each weekend. If he comes out and he just basically tanks a weekend, look for Vitantonio to jump into the car.
And I hope so, because I like Vitantonio. He's a good man. So anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with our favorite segment, Motorsports Mondial. And of course, there's always an extra goodie bag from Nasser Hamid. So we'll be back after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Clark Rogers, host of F1Weekly.com's podcast. Please visit our website, F1Weekly.com, your fresh new destination for all your Formula One needs. F1Weekly.com brings you a weekly podcast that covers the latest news, rumors, and insightful commentary related to the pinnacle of modern motorsports, Formula One. You can find us on iTunes and other popular podcast locations. F1Weekly.com. Thank you.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And the white Camry limousine has pulled up to the studios. And, of course, the elegant and glamorous Nasser Hamid has made it to corporate headquarters. Nass, good evening, and how are you?
You mean the chauffeur and the guest being the same person, which is moi?
Exactly.
Thank you, sir. Greetings and a very warm welcome to the United States of Open Wheel Racing.
Absolutely outstanding. So we're jumping right into the globe-spinning motorsports.
Yes, right from Gasoline Alley. A big thank you, I must say, to the powers that be at IRL and Champ Car Racing for putting an end to the decade-long self-destruction of what was once a great international racing series. And later in the podcast, we will take a look at the timeline of the Great Divide. And now we will spin the globe and go to the streets of South Africa in Durban. A1 GP Series, 18-year-old Canadian sensation Robert Wickens, who I think is wicked fast, became the youngest pole winner and then scored his first win in the series by winning the sprint race. And I was looking at the Speed TV schedule of events. I have not seen it for the whole week, but I'm sure somewhere during the week they will insert it. And if I find out, I'll put it on the forum what time the race is coming on. It's normally on Wednesdays around 10 or 12 California time. But this kid, keep an eye on Robert Wickens. I think this kid is going places. Oliver Jarvis was second for Team GBR, and Neil Johnny was third for Team Switzerland. Team USA with Jonathan Summerton, they finished 11th but were promoted to 10th. After German driver Michael Emmer Müller was excluded from his sixth place finish for crashing into Dutchman Jeroen Bleekemolen. And Little Bleek, as he is known in Holland, was not very happy with Emmer Müller. And if you recall, Mr. Emmer Müller had like three run-ins in the race at Sepang. So not good going. I mean, he's a pretty quick driver. I mean, he's turning into a PT of A1GP. Paul Tracy, that is. I mean, if you're quick, you don't need to crash into people.
He needs to get into a car with fenders.
Oh, now we have a German also coming into Linus car, Das Nest car.
Yeah, exactly. Put him in speed car.
Yeah. Feature race, the winner was Swiss driver Neil Johnny, Loire Duval. He was very impressive for Team France. You know, he's doing a series in Japan, so he came in at the last minute, had very little testing, and then went out and finished second. And third was Miguel's homeboy, Felipe Albuquerque, for Team Portugal. And I believe this was his first race in this series. So very impressive to be third on the on the podium first time out. So Team Switzerland now leads the championship ahead of Team France, and Team New Zealand is third. Now we go from South Africa to Australia. Season opener was held in the V8 series, that is, in the streets of Adelaide. Both rounds in the Clipsal 500 were won by Ford Falcon driver Jamie Wincup. Unfortunately, an accident in one of the support races claimed the life of 27-year-old Ashley Cooper. He was a driver from New South Wales. From Australia, we move forward to Fontana. Rain-delayed cup race, which was run on Monday, was won by Carl Edwards in his Ford Fusion. Montoya was 20th and Dario Franchitti 32nd. The nationwide race series, previously known as the Busch Series, was won by Tony Stewart in his Toyota.
Quick question. I guess...
easy question, please.
Jacques Villeneuve is out of NASCAR now?
I don't know what's going on. He was on Wind Tunnel with Dave Despain over the weekend, and, you know, he's doing the Le Mans thing, and he's saying it's not a complete, you know, dished-out deal. If he can find a sponsor, he'll be back in. So let's see what happens. And they asked him, you know, with the series merging, would you go to IndyCars or whatever they want to call it now? He says, no, you know, I've done that, I've won that, so I want a new challenge. So let's see what happens.
Excellent. Maybe he could find some of that Jean Zalesi and motivation.
Yeah, motivation. Good for him. I'm sure, Clark, you've heard of this gentleman, Paul Frere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this you know, really takes me back to my early days of following Formula One. He was one of the most famous motoring journalists. He passed away over the last week. The Belgian also drove in 11 Formula One races. His best finish came in his final Grand Prix at Spa in 1956. He was second. And Paul Freire was one of the first motorsport journalists that I got to know from following. When I started following Racing Magazine, I would see a lot of articles or references to Paul Freire, photographs and stuff like that. In 1960, he won the Le Mans 24-hour race with fellow Belgian driver Olivier Jean-Debien in a Ferrari, and he was 91 years old. I read that he was testing some sort of a Honda Civic at the Nürburgring last year and had a pretty bad accident and injured himself and never fully recovered from that accident. Now we have a case of not from but to Russia with love. Hans Geist, ex-head honcho for the Austrian Grand Prix, is leading the charge to build an F1 spec racing track west of Moscow. The plan is to host MotoGP and DTM races with an eye to an F1 event someday. And what a surprise, Herman Tilke is the track designer.
Isn't there anybody else in the world that designs tracks?
I mean, come on. Can't they get Tiger Woods or something?
Or Rusty Wallace?
Yeah.
You know, he can design a real killer circle track in, I'm sure. In Moscow.
Yeah, but he uses the old ostrich egg method.
Because I heard from some, I once asked somebody who was heavily involved in Formula One, why is Herman Tilke? And he said, because, you know, his buddies with whatever he gets, Bernie gets a cut.
Exactly.
It's, you know, it's like the GP2 series. It's owned by Bernie and Flavio, and the engines are prepared by Mechachrome, which is owned by
Flavio.
There you go. So
it's one big happy family over there, isn't it?
Yeah, a system feeding itself. Well, what can you do? Some news on driver signings. Ryan Hunter-Reay will compete in the Unified IRL Series with Ray Hall Letterman team. Race-winning American talent getting a decent ride, which is good for the sport. And I think this future should be very good for open wheel if people continue to work together. Alexander Rossi from Northern California, we interviewed this young kid last year. He will race again this year in the renamed Formula BMW Americas with Euro International Team. And this series will also race on the same weekend as the Brazilian Grand Prix at Sao Paulo.
That's okay. Beautiful.
That explains the Americas.
Yeah, exactly. They've done the same thing in Europe also, the Formula BMW UK merging. Okay, a German driver, Christian Fitores, who had taken part earlier in the F3 series and also Formula BMW, is going to do the F3 Euro Series this year with Berlin-based Mucke Motorsport. And last but not the least, our favorite Miss Venezuela, Milka Duno, has signed with Dreyer and Reinbold Racing to run a limited schedule in IRL.
Excellent.
And she does not have to take any wrath from Miss Ashley Judd now, because last year at one of the races, Miss Judd was very upset with Milka. Whatever happened to girl power and love for the
we're not
fellow
gonna get
cat.
Into that.
Yeah, of course.
That hair pulling stuff.
She's making eyes at Dario.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, a question for you. Did you ever go to any Champ Car race before the split? Yes or no?
Oh, in the old days?
Yes, in the old days.
No.
How about you, Mr.
Fahd? The cart. Yeah. C-A-R, yeah.
No, I actually, my first motor race that I actually attended in person was the Indianapolis 500 in 2006.
You mean 500
the US Grand Prix?
Grand Prix.
Sorry. Oh, really? Okay, well, that's good. It used to be a big series, you know. I mean, I used to follow it, enjoyed it very much, and I'm very happy about this thing. So we have what I would call our Roberta Flack segment, Killing Me Softly with his song. A look at the open wheel split timeline and what happened. Some major, you know, what led to this disaster. CART, which stood for Championship Auto Racing Team, came into being in 1979 after Dan Gurney, Pat Patrick, and Roger Penske split away from the then-sanctioning body, which used to be USAC, United States Automobile Club, and they were not happy that USAC was like a mundane old institution. This should be more like run like Bernie Ecclestone's Formula One empire, you know, very beneficial financially to the participants and all that. So they split, and history tells us that Gordon Johncock from Coldwater, Michigan, was the winner of the very first kart race, the Arizona Republic Jimmy Bryan 150 at Phoenix International Raceway on March 11, 1979. Now, March 11 is a pretty important date, as we shall see further down the road. As the years go by, Rick Mears, the Unsers, Andretti, Fittipaldi, and Nigel Mansell were all champions in major names in American motorsport. But the series became a victim of its own international success, and I would say arrogance also. Tony George, owner of Indianapolis Motor Speedway, felt left out, and his cries for more American grassroots type oval racing fell on deaf ears. And I have actually read and heard from people who were involved, senior people in Champ Cars in those days, or CART, that anytime there would be a meeting and Tony George was pretty much the odd man out, his ideas were always just like scoffed at. They would laugh at him. Basically, you know, it was like, hey, we run the show, who are you? So it was no surprise what happened. So we come to this thing called history repeat itself, and revenge is sweet. On March 11, the same day that Gordon Johncock won the race, in 1994, exactly 15 years from the day of Gordy's win in the desert, Tony George gave CART a taste of their own medicine by announcing the formation of an all-oval series, today known as Indy Racing League.
But a question, before this Indy Racing League was started in 1994, CART did run at the Indianapolis Speedway.
Yeah, they ran every year, but the race was sanctioned by USAC.
Okay, exactly.
And that's what Tony George really had. And I got to tell you, almost everybody, and definitely myself included, we just totally underestimated the importance of Indy 500 in American racing. I mean, this whole open wheel series in America is all Indy. It's like this, you know, even before long before the split, I used to say, if a driver, if there are 20 races in the schedule, and Indy 500 is one of them, a driver who wins 19 of them, mainstream Americana will not know him, but the guy who wins the Indy 500, I mean, he's in the White House, he's everywhere. So it's just, it has taken so much time and heritage to build this thing up. So it's paid well for Tony George, finally. Some of the events dates, January 27, 1996, the early years were Mickey Mouse for IRL. I'm sure you have watched some of the races where nobody was there in the stands. Their inaugural event in Orlando at Walt Disney World Speedway was won by Buzz Calkins. Now, how many American racing fans know Buzz Calkins? You know what I'm saying? Even the championship was a shared affair, with Calkins and Scott Sharp becoming joint champions. I mean, this is how flaky this thing was. May 26, 1996, with most of the CART teams locked out in 1996, because 1996 was the first year of this series, Tony George had mandated that like 25 of the slots will be for people who are competing in the IRL full-time, so CART boycotted. The Indy 500 that year was won by Buddy Lazier from Colorado. In the first of many brain-fades CART stages, US 500, same day as Indy 500, and this was done at the Michigan Speedway. Jimmy Vassar won this race after causing an 11-car pileup on the pace lap. And I remember this, you know, actually Michigan Speedway was a great track. It's faster than Indy, but I mean, Indy has the history, you know. May 28, 2000, I was at this event, very proud to say that. The Monty Python Show makes an appearance at the Brickyard with Chip Ganassi Racing. The brash Colombian is worn by two-time winner Al Unser Jr. to respect the walls as they can bite you. Montoya, being Montoya, pays no attention to the Indy veteran and led 167 of 200 laps and got milk, first rookie to do so since Graham Hill in 1966. Very, very impressive. And I believe a few years down the road, our Dancing with the Star, Mr. Elio Castroneves, also won on his debut. And I think he went on one second year also, and third year he was second to his teammate. December 6, 2001, this is really the last straw. Captain and team announced they are sailing to choppy waters of IRL for the 2002 season, and captain, of course, is Roger Penske, with their two Brazilian pilots, Elio Castroneves and then-teammate Gilles de Ferran. March 2003, Penske and Ganassi are joined by Michael Andretti, who used to be a very big, loudmouth critic of IRL. His team also joins IRL. Honda and Toyota both join the party, but empty grandstands continue to be the most visible feature of the series. And you know, it was around this time I went to the, I had been to two Champ Car races at Fontana. Great event, great track built by Mr. Penske. And the last time I went was a few years ago, IRL event. It was, it was just very sad to see a major event happening and like 70% of the seats are empty. Pretty sad. But I'll tell you something, those cars, when they are traveling at over 200 miles per hour, the sound they make, very satisfying. I must say, you should go to an oval race one of these days. Open wheel race, that is.
Okay, I'll have to drink a lot of coffee.
Coffee? Okay, no problem. I'll get some for you. Okay, now we come to January 28, 2004. Armed with a blank check, Tony George appears in the U.S. bankruptcy court to buy the bankrupt Rival Series, because at that time, Champ Cars has filed bankruptcy, and bury the series forever. But this strategy backfires as the judge awards the racing assets of a bankrupt car to a group of team owners despite a lower bid so they can keep the series alive. And we know who all these people are. Kevin Kalkowen, Jerry Forsythe, and Paul Gentilozzi. I would like to know how Paul Gentilozzi got into this, because he was always a road racer in Trans Am and GTO type racing. Maybe he had a lot of money, I don't know. But we'll get down to the heart of this matter someday. And finally, the big day, February 22, 2008, Indy Racing League and Champ Car officials sign agreement in principle to unify the sport. There are a lot of issues that need to be resolved. Both have feeder series, IPS Indy Pro Series and the Atlantic, which will survive. Maybe they both will. But, you know, it will take, I think the racing fans of America who got the shaft for 10 plus years, I mean, they need to, and we are included in that group too, they just need to move forward and support these people. And hopefully these people will really work to make this thing succeed now. It will take quite a few years. According to Dan Gurney, open wheel racing in this country will never get back to what it used to be. But I think with some good names, I mean, they really need to have some very competitive American names. There's no question about it. You know, a couple of American names, maybe some Mansell's kids, you know, that will help. And then people will come.
Fantastic. Keep up the good work, Nasser.
I think the other thing they're going to need is a good mix of both road and oval racing, because I think if you just go heavy oval, you're going to lose a lot of the people that are road racing types and vice versa. That's part of the reason the two series never really got anywhere, is because they didn't have a good mix.
No, in the heydays of Champ Car, it was really a very nice mix. They had a few big oval races. They were running at Fontana, Michigan, Indy, of course. Pocono was there for many years. So if they can have three or four big ovals, and they realize how, I mean, the St. Petersburg race, ILL race, is a big draw. So they can really...
They'll probably end up keeping the ones that were getting the best gate and kind of go from there.
The Canadian road races, the Australian road race, they have Long Beach. I mean, Long Beach for me and my friends were just like an annual ritual, you know, for years and years and years.
Fantastic. So let's hope that becomes successful. Thank you, Nas. We're going to take a quick break and come back with a story about our last American Grand Prix winner. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
F1Weekly.com would like to thank our sponsor, San Jose Label Inc. San Jose Label is a custom manufacturer of labels that makes a variety of products. 1-4 color process labels, alphanumeric barcoding and UPC labels, blank labels, serialized asset tags, hazardous labels, bumper stickers, pin feed, static cling, hot stamp labels, and many others. Please go to www.sanjoselabel.com for info, samples requests, and graphic design. Or you can call to telephone 408-436-8221. San Jose Label is the one-stop shop for all your labeling needs.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now to the Peter Revson story. And of course, I must correct myself. I meant American-born Grand Prix driver, because we certainly haven't forgotten about Mario, our wonderful Mario Andretti. So, Nas, welcome back to the studio after your quick tea break, and give us this wonderful story, because this is a good story.
Yes, sir. This gentleman was around when I started following racing. Peter Revson, the story is called Scent of Success. Since the introduction of Formula One World Championship in 1950, only five American drivers have won a Grand Prix race, and Peter Revson is one of them. And if you take out Mario Andretti, he is the last U.S.-born driver to win a Formula One race. So the last U.S. Grand Prix winner, U.S.-born Grand Prix winner, would be Canada 1973. So we desperately need some more talent from Manteca. Revson, reason we are doing this, he was born this week in 1939.
Exactly. That's the clinker.
Exactly. And Peter Revson was born on February 27th, 1939 in New York City. His father, Martin, and uncle, Charles, were founders of Revlon Cosmetics.
So that's some good financial backing right there.
Yeah, but you know, just like in the case of Danny Solomon, his success was not built on family money. Family was not interested in going racing. And his father actually left Revlon Corporation, I think, in 1958. So Peter never even worked in the business. But I'm sure early years were softened by the financial wealth of the family, no question about that. While at Cornell University in upstate New York, Peter met a man who would later become his roommate in Manhattan and team owner in Formula One, Teddy Mayer. And what a story that is. Revson's racing career started in the early 60s. As a student in Hawaii, he entered local club events. He drove his Morgan to a second-place finish in his first race and won the next event. But real drama followed after his third race, where he was apparently thrown out of the club for aggressive driving. And Clark, this takes me back to the very, this what I just said right now, to the very early 70s. This was the first thing I ever read about Peter Revson. I had a book back home, small book. It was called International Motor Racing. And it had like a paragraph or two about famous drivers and tracks. And this is exactly what it says about Peter Revson, that he was asked not to come back to the club. In 1962, he joined forces with Teddy Mayer's brother Tim and formed Rev-M Formula Junior Racing Team, with Teddy running the operation. They took their show to Europe for the 1963 season, highlight of which was Revson's victory in Denmark, and he also made his Formula One debut in the non-championship Gold Cup race at Alton Park in England, finishing ninth in his Lotus BRM. The race was won by, surprise, surprise, Jim Clark. A tragedy struck in early 1964 when Timmy Mayer was killed in Australia during a Tasman Series race. Revson raced off and on in Europe for the next two seasons. He took part in six Formula One events in 1964 with the Lotus BRM run by Reg Parnell. His main prize was victory in the prestigious F3 race at Monaco in 1965. But despite this, he was unable to land a factory ride in Formula One and returned to sports car racing in the U.S. And you know, I've tried to find out, I'm not sure, but I think Revson probably is the only American to win that Monaco F3 race, which is a very famous, prestigious event. So if anybody out there knows anybody else who was American and won that race, please let us know. 1966, he mainly concentrated on sports car racing. He raced a Ford GT40 and scored several class wins. In 1967, during a Formula 3 race in Denmark, his younger brother Douglas was killed, and despite objection from the family, Peter continued his own racing career. He took two Trans Am wins that year in a Mercury Cougar prepared by Bud Moore of NASCAR fame. And, you know, we've talked about how big Trans Am was in this country in the late 60s and early 70s. 1969 saw him win the IndyCar race at Indianapolis Raceway Park. And I believe this is the track where Mario Andretti also scored his very first IndyCar win. Peter was driving a Brabham Repco. He also finished fifth at the Indy 500 despite starting last on the grid of 33 cars. In 1970, he was teammate to Mark Donohue in the Penske-run AMC Javelin Trans Am team. He was second in the 1970 Sebring 12 Hours with Steve McQueen as co-driver in a privately entered Porsche 908. The following year, 1971, he became the first American to win the Can-Am Championship driving for McLaren, with victories at Road Atlanta, Watkins Glen, Elkhart Lake, Road America, Brainerd, Minnesota, and Laguna Seca, right here in Northern California. Another bright point in the season was his pole and second place at the Brickyard on Memorial Day weekend. End of season saw him in a Tyrrell do a lap at the U.S. Grand Prix before retiring. The car broke down. Peter and Teddy Mayer got together again in 1972, this time as driver and manager in Formula One respectively at Team McLaren. Revson finished fifth in the championship and was on the podium in South Africa, Britain, Austria, and Canada, where he was on pole and finished second. Revson finished third in his very first IROC race, International Race of Champions that is, at Riverside in 1973, behind Mark Donohue and Bobby Unser, and finished the season as runner-up in the championship. So as you can see, he was a pretty good driver. In the Formula One World Championship, he was again fifth in the standings, but scored two Grand Prix wins, both in the rain. The first at Silverstone, where he held off Ronnie Peterson's late charge in his JPS Lotus, and the second at Mossport in the chaotic Canadian Grand Prix, where a safety car was deployed for the first time in Formula One racing. Revson fell out of favor with Teddy Mayer and refused to be the third driver at McLaren. He then joined fellow American Don Nichols, who now lives here in Northern California also, and his UOP shadow operation after talks with Ferrari broke down as possible teammate to Niki Lauda. I'm trying to get more information on this, but looked like that they were very serious in hiring him as a teammate to Niki Lauda for the 74 season. In the opening two races in South America, he was not running at the finish, but season looked promising as he had qualified on the second row in Argentina and third row in Brazil. Tragedy struck in preparation for the third race of the season in South Africa. On the 22nd of March 1974, his Tony Southgate designed Shadow Cosworth suffered a suspension failure at high speed approaching the barbecue bend, resulting in a fiery destruction of his race car. Graham Hill and Emerson Fittipaldi were the first drivers on the scene, but there was nothing they could do. Peter Revson remains to this day the last American-born Grand Prix winner. And at the time of his death, his girlfriend was a lady by the name of Marjorie Wallace, and she had the distinction of being the first American to win the Miss World competition. So there you have it, folks, a little history on Peter Revson from New York.
Outstanding, Nasser. Keep up the good work with the historical perspective. And now we're going to go quickly into the wrap-up. And, of course, we have no F1Weekly.com forum newsletter until after the Australian Grand Prix, which is very, very soon. I'm excited. Fernando on pole position should be a big thrill for me.
I have a question for you. You know, season ends and we have a 3-4 month lull. I have no problem waiting for that. 2 months, no problem. 1 month, 3 weeks, no problem. But it's the day of the race, the last 3-4 hours, they are excruciatingly painful.
That Saturday is going to be a long day.
You know what I do?
I am like a cat on a hot tin roof.
I put a little apron on and I cook little hors d'oeuvres and stuff and get all excited. I get my goat cheese just right, my anchovies, my escargot, maybe have a couple of quiches baking in the oven. It's pretty exciting stuff. And, of course, une bouteille de champagne.
Any roux burger for the Australian Grand Prix?
No roux burger. Oh, man. This is civilization.
You're skipping that.
Completely.
Some ostrich egg omelets.
And there you go. And, of course, all my omelets are made just like they do on Mont-Saint-Michel in the copper pot.
Mont-Saint-Michel.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So there you have it. Okay, Stephen, enough with the small talk, me and Nass. We need some female.
Or some general email.
No, we can have general
this
email.
This need to be female. But the first one does have a female theme.
Excellent.
The first one is from NorCal Racer, and he writes Danica pronunciation. Danica Patrick's first name is pronounced Dan, D-A-N-I-K-A. It is not pronounced Don, D-O-N-I-K-A, like you continue to say. I consider pronunciation very important when discussing any sporting topic. Please don't dismiss it. Thank you, Cal Racer. We will endeavor to get it correct in the future.
I've been practicing, and I've got it. Danica. Miss Danica Patrick.
Maybe throw it in, maybe think of a little bit of Southern accent, kind of Danica.
No, she's from Arizona. There is no Southern accent. It's Danica. I'm practicing. Thank you, Carlos. Changes have been implemented.
With immediate effect.
Yes, our next email is from a longtime listener, Mr. James Noble, and he writes about podcast 254. I'm writing to inform you of the pain and suffering podcast 254 has caused me. This may strike you as odd, but I listen to the podcast occasionally while on the lavatory. I don't like to accuse anyone in particular, but the podcast as a whole has had a very negative effect on my life. You see, I was walking into the bathroom, turned on the podcast, then suddenly dropped the iPod video into the toilet. This would have never happened if podcast 254 was not released. So I think it's acceptable to charge you with the repair replacement bill. I am sure you will be happy to pay and expect the payment ASAP. I hope you are all well. James Noble.
No problem. The infamous bonus checks from F1
Weekly. Just tell us how many zeros you want it, and we'll send you a check.
As many zeros as necessary to replace the
said item. I wonder if this might have something to do with the lack of a newsletter until after Australia. I have no clue, but
we're going to move on, and our condolences to the iPod, of course.
Yeah, to his iPod.
Okay, real quickly, before I go into the wrap-up, we do support our local Formula One activities around the nation and the world. And, of course, if anybody is doing an activity or a meeting and you'd like to advertise or...
just, you know, have it promoted on our podcast.
Just send us an email where, when, and how, and we'll read it. This is the San Francisco Formula One.com group. They've got a new website, and on March 1st, they're going on a guided tour of the Canepa Designs. This is an opportunity to see their automotive museum and facilities in Scotts Valley, California. And we're talking Top Gear stuff in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Examples of their collection include the Porsche 962 No. 2 run at Le Mans and the Monster Can-Am Porsche 917 No. 17, a car with 1,100 horsepower, 0 to 100 in 3 seconds. And they obviously also have lots of other cars. They do restoration. You can have them do your Hummer or what have you. They're a big organization over there, and they also have one of the former Arrows Formula One cars. So go to the website if you want to attend that, sff1.com, and please RSVP. That'll be on March 1st. Also, they'll be meeting for the live Australian Grand Prix at the Overtime Sports Bar and Grill, and everybody needs to show up there March 15th, 9 p.m., as the flag drops. You can Google the Overtime Sports Bar and Grill, which I believe...
is in the city somewhere?
Is in the city. So there you have it. The Keep city, up the good work. This is from...
the city being San Francisco.
Yeah, this is from Mr. Peter Habish.
And let the people know that you and I met through this organization.
Exactly. This is how me and Nass actually met. I had my beautiful... picture of my beautiful French face.
In front of what track?
Oh, my favorite track, Reims.
Yes, and I immediately sent an email to Mr. Rogers saying, that must be Reims where you are at.
So it wasn't my charm and good looks, it was just the background.
Yeah, exactly. It's always the background. It was
this dilapidated grandstand.
Dilapidated grandstands, but it's always, that's a pilgrimage to whomever goes to Reims.
Absolutely.
It's, you feel...
yeah, and I want to thank Peter for sending us this email and keeping us posted. And his, again, website is www.sff1.com. So thank you, sir.
Keep up the good work. F1 Weekly is also pleased to offer our listeners Saison 73's beautiful and historical Formula One calendar for 2008. Theme for the new calendar is Motorsports Memories Lost Tracks. $14.95 plus shipping and handling. A bargain at twice the price, I should say. So please go to the merchandise page and click on it. You know you want to. Let's go to our MySpace site, F1 Weekly, www.myspace.com/F1Weekly. Check us out. Make us your friend and ours, blah, blah. I don't go there very often. How about you, Steven?
No, not very often.
Yeah, I think this is more of our producer, David Tapia's site. He loves it there. He's got a lot of his pictures, his friends. So if you want to check out David Tapia, this is where you go. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email us at info@f1weekly.com. I want to thank everyone who helps this show come together as a clicking organization. And that would be Toby, David, Steve, Nasser, Desiree, and the wonderful Clark Rogers. So there you have it. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
This is Desiree for f1weekly.com. Thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.